parson or no parson? A 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 parson or no parson?
Let's talk about Tarleton. Charlton.
Or no
parson. Tarleton's reputation.
We talk about Charlton Heston. I don't think that conversation would go very far. They explain anything about him.
No.
Celebrity.
Yeah. Very, very, very different, though. Going off on a weird tangent. Okay, this is not going yet.
Very weird tangent. This is what my seminars are like. It's just like, woo, tangent. Let's return.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say in what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. And in October, we are voting for some of the future productions that we're going to be pulling together. It's a structured vote around stuff we've done exploring workshops on. So if you'd like a vote on what we do next, this is the month to join. $1 a month is the starting price. That's about, it's $12 a year. Less than that if you're from another country and there's a decent exchange rate. Exchange rates vary. Anyway, today I'm delighted to be joined by Sophie Shoreland.
My name is Sophie Shoreland. I am currently researching early modern celebrity culture.
And those adventures in early modern celebrity have led us on a merry dance the last few months, as I've been workshopping some of the material discussed, and let's just say we've been down not a few rabbit holes. This is sometimes why future shows that have been planned get a little bit delayed, because I get distracted by exciting shiny things. So throughout this discussion, I will be joined by Lee MacDonald and Mark Scanlon, who I tried out some of the material on, as well as some test recordings with Hugh Wellapooley, who you heard trying out every possible way of saying a parson or no parson. The texts they tried out were Tarleton's Jests, a series of short humorous tales printed in theory about Richard Tarleton, actor, clown, extraordinary. And Richard Tarleton is the central figure of this episode, though we do discuss other famous people from the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Many thanks to those actors for helping us piece together how these stories function. Many apologies for leaving most of their work on the cutting room floor. But that's the process, I'm afraid. That's the way I work. But it all started many months ago when I spoke to Sophie Shoreland about early modern celebrity, famous names and their animal avatars. We do briefly discuss details of cockfighting and bear baiting later, so be warned, it's a little depressing. So, anyway, celebrities. Can we really say that there were such things before the internet?
About celebrity then. So we did a pre-chat, the listeners at home.
So we had a little pre-chat and you were talking about how celebrity and the idea of celebrity culture is perhaps a little controversial when talking about the early modern period, and there's some debate. If you'd like to talk about celebrity now and then and questions thereof.
Yeah, so I mean, for a lot of people, it's surprising that celebrity in the early modern period is controversial, especially if you have any knowledge of kind of classical culture and think of kind of gladiators, things like that, then people tend to think of them being celebrities. But in a kind of scholarly context, early modern celebrity is a bit controversial because lots of people argue that you can't have celebrity without newspapers. Or without, some people say the close-up shot in film is what kind of creates the intimacy between the celebrity and their fan, mm-hmm. and creates the idea of a fan of the celebrity. I'm kind of looking at, were there fans in an early modern context? How did people feel about celebrities, did celebrities exist? The word does exist at this time, and Chaucer's using it in a slightly different way, but in roughly the same way as we use it now, as kind of synonymous with renown. Lots of texts do seem to be grappling with ideas of fame, with celebrity. So lots of Philip Sidney's writing, you can read as kind of trying to mediate between fan expectations of his life and the life he's actually leading, and where those come into tension, and trying to kind of find places of privacy within this quite public-facing life.
Mm. So in the sense, you were saying that, you know, questions of print culture. So, okay, there aren't newspapers, but there are other outlets for print. And what sort of time are we talking here? Because we've gone from Chaucer to a little later. So where do we narrow our focus down?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of interested in how pamphlets and ballads and lots of kind of printed ephemera are creating celebrity. So it certainly exists before, I would say, anyway. But I'm looking principally at from around 1580 to kind of 1620s. Mm. Because, you know, after that point, then there are some changes in publicity and the mechanisms of self-publicity. So the picture starts to get slightly different.
And because obviously our podcast is all about, largely about drama, there's obviously also the performative element of celebrity, that, you know, you've got people who are publicly recognisable and seen by a significant number of people, if not necessarily as wide an audience as other times allows. I'm leading us gently in the direction of the names that I know we're going to talk about, but, you know, that sense of there is a widest areas of celebrity as well as print culture.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, it's difficult sometimes because, you know, we're looking at a time of kind of where oral culture meets print and written culture. So some local celebrities we don't really have much record of, but you do have record of some kind of one-hit wonders, like the fishwives of Billingsgate, who were famous for kind of swearing at each other and insulting each other, and were the subject of pamphlets. But yeah, and then you get celebrities who kind of rise to fame through the medium of the stage, people like Edward Allen, Richard Burbage, Will Kemp. And then you have kind of some interesting celebrities like Richard Tarleton, who is in this really interesting liminal period. So he's part court jester. He's kind of Elizabeth I's jester, but he's also performing on stage as part of the Queen's Men.
So they're figures who would be publicly known, and they're known via a number of routes, if that's a way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. And often we know about them more from kind of afterlives. Mm. So Tarleton, for example, was so beloved that his picture was often used on inn signs after his death, and possibly also on toilet doors. whether that's love or something else, I don't know. And various pamphlets kind of resurrected his memory. So it was almost kind of people didn't really want to let him go. Plus, he was, you know, putting his name on a pamphlet meant that your pamphlet would sell really well, yeah, to other fans.
I just want to jump in there on the do we have any surviving images of Tarleton that would, the idea that his face is obviously identifiable?
Yes, it's totally identifiable. All the images of Tarleton actually stem from one image in manuscript, which is part of an alphabet book. So the alphabet book says T for Tarleton, and then it has this completely fabulous, very ornamental letter with Tarleton kind of doing a jig. And all pictures, we think, come from this one image. But the fact that he's used in an alphabet book as this kind of reference point for people learning language kind of speaks to his influence as well.
What are the other letters in the alphabet represented by?
I don't know, actually. I zoomed in on Tarleton, but I mean, that's, yeah. I think it's things like Apple.
Yeah.
And really, really standard. And then Tarleton springs up. I should look through all the letters and see if there's another person there, because that would be interesting.
Oh, this is just a structure for a show in my mind. I'm just going, A is for Apple, B is for T is for Tarleton. Let's talk about that. Let's look through the round window.
But also, I mean, there's like an accepted verbal picture of him as well. So he's, you know, you always know it's Tarleton because he always has a suit of russet, which is kind of this peasant dress. Mm. He always has a tabor, which is a small drum, and he always has his pipe. So and he often has a squint as well.
So there are a series of sort of signifiers that are really clear, that are matched directly to him and no one else.
Yeah, and this is the case with a few celebrities. They're just kind of instantly conjured by this couple of references. Mm. And even without the name, you would know, oh, that's Tarleton, or, you know, oh, that's Malkut Purse. Or...
Just to sort of backtrack, but we mentioned Philip Sidney earlier, just briefly, just to pass to him, because obviously he has a sort of tangential connection with the stage, writing about it, if not necessarily doing anything specifically with it. Because he's obviously slightly earlier. He is slightly earlier, isn't he? So his fame, how does that differ from, say, Tarleton, who is obviously a very public figure in a very specific way?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are differences because with Sidney, there's an element of hereditary kind of fame. So his father is pro-Rex of Ireland. He's the nephew of very influential people. But he's also kind of part of broader celebrity culture. So he actually becomes Tarleton's son's godfather. So they, being a celebrity kind of connected you in this interesting way. Mm. And Sidney... The reason for him being a celebrity has kind of been a bit of a mystery, because he allegedly, anyway, wasn't particularly good looking. He wasn't particularly diplomatically talented. He kind of put his foot on it, in fact, in a few quite critical situations. And he didn't have England wasn't at war very much, so he didn't have a particularly impressive war record. Mm. And his writing was published posthumously. Mm. So it has been a bit of a mystery why the kind of common people loved him so much. But he did take part in tilts and tourneys. Mm. And these would have an audience of potentially thousands of people. Holinshed talks about hundreds dying when some scaffolding collapsed on the assembled audience of one of these kinds of entertainment. And Sidney's own writing talks about kind of the people's shouts at this kind of entertainment and being very conscious of being watched. And then these things were transformed into print as well and circulated through the country. So his name was kind of mentioned in accounts of tilt and tourney as being, he was particularly impressive.
So there's sort of the lifetime, if you know, or maybe less fame, more known of, and then maybe there's more print posthumous life. Are they almost separate artifacts, or are they... Do tell me if I'm wrong. I'm just sort of dancing around.
Yeah, particularly with Sidney, you only really get evidence of his fame coming out after his death. But immediately after his death, there's this whole slew of kind of really, really intensely emotional poems and... Yeah, loads of poems written mourning him, saying things like, you know, the whole country is wearing black, we will never be the same again. It's kind of Princess Diana levels of mourning for Sidney. And people felt this very, very personal connection to him. One writer even resurrects him in poem form and takes Sidney's voice and pretends to be Sidney's ghost, watching everyone crying for him. Yeah, and you get that with some other celebrities as well. It's really on their death that you kind of can begin to understand the scale of public affection for them.
And so he was tangentially connected to Tarleton?
So Sidney was Tarleton's son's godfather, yeah.
So the idea that celebrity begets celebrity.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, with Tarleton it's interesting because, you know, he's born, presumably we don't really know that much about his early life, but he's kind of relatively low status. So without celebrity status, he may not have had Sydney as his son's godfather.
Mm. So now that we're back on Tarleton, though actually Sydney was very interesting, we know a lot about Tarleton sort of posthumously again. Is that where we're coming from? Or is there more within his life that, if not about fame, but just references to his existence?
Well, there are plenty of references to his existence, but it's very difficult to kind of untangle fact from fiction. So, and a lot of the references kind of are testifying to his popular reputation. So, for example, you know, it's said that a woman can sing to the tune of Tarleton, someone has a Tarletonizing wit, some kind, particular kinds of jests were called Tarletons. And actually, biographically, if I were a biographer, it's a bit of a nightmare to disentangle all the stories told about him from his actual life. But so we kind of
Well, you were saying that she could
sing to the tune of Tarleton.
So did he have a theme tune?
Yeah, presumably he had a popular song called Tarleton that had a tune that was very well known, and you could sing to it.
So when was he born and when did he die, approximately? Because I'm sure there's some debate as to precisely when.
So we really have no idea when he was born.
Yeah.
Or even in which part of the country. It might have been London, it might have been somewhere else. Maybe around 1530, but that is pure speculation. He definitely died in 1588.
Good year to die. Good year to die.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if it's better than any other year, but
it's,
yeah.
It's an interesting year. You know, things happened.
Yeah, well, and he was kind of talked about so much that one writer actually kind of complains and says, I've had enough of talking about Tarleton. Like, you know, I know he's died, but this is too much. And this is 2 years after his death in 1590 that this writer is saying, no, I've had enough.
Was he associated with a specific company or playhouse or that kind of thing? Or was he
He was part of the Queen's Men. Mm. He also spent quite a bit of time at court. So, you know, he was Elizabeth's semi-official court jester. He owned several pubs, so he personally may have been a bit of a draw to the pubs, and that's where he may have developed his style of comedy, working in a pub, but we are really not sure.
Well, it is interesting looking at the some of the jests is that, you know, a lot of this is repartee. It's about being very quick on your feet with a response. You know, that being a clown, being not just a physical clown, not just a musician, but being very verbally fast. That seems to be what I'm getting from what I've seen. Do contradict me if I'm horribly wrong.
No, you're exactly right. That's kind of one of the things that Tarleton was particularly remembered for. So, I mean, if we look at, say, Tarleton's greeting with Banks, his horse, I can't say that I understand this joke particularly. I mean, feel free to enlighten me. But God a mercy, a horse is thought to be particularly hilarious as a response. It becomes a byword through London to this day. And I mean, the jests are compiled. It's a slightly odd publication history, but this particular jest, I think, was published in 1611. So this is quite a long time after his death, you know, more than 20 years. And this is still being spoken about as the height of hilarity.
I mean, I'm going to workshop this with an actor or actors over the next month or so as we edit this into a thing. So I'll be able to give maybe a sort of a side note inserted about here saying what we think this precise joke is. Hello, it's future Robert stepping in now to take you through the rabbit hole that was the Tarleton jest of Banks horse. We've done several sessions on this story and still haven't actually done a proper one. And here's an extended sidebar on all the work and on the story itself. We keep going back over it because it touches on a different celebrity who I didn't explicitly discuss with Sophie and who needs some introduction. So, first of all, Banks was a showman in his own right, which is quite important to this story. And his horse is no ordinary horse. It is a performing horse called Morocco, who can do various tricks like count out numbers and grab audience members on command. So the events of the story only make sense when you appreciate that it's about two, or should I say three, skilled performers squaring off with one another in a public space. Now, the way we work is to throw text at different performers and see what comes up. So here's a cut-down, jumbled-up journey through this jest with, first off, Lee MacDonald, and then spliced in with another session with Mark Scanlon, and occasional bursts of Hugh Weller-Pooley as Tolton. I remain, however, Robert Crichton. This one is one of the... This one's hilarious, this one coming up.
Tarleton's is it? Greeting. That's a lot of pressure.
There's a lot of pressure. I'll do Tarleton for you.
You do Tarleton,
we've done a lot of work on this.
Go on then. Okay. There was one Banks in the time of Tarleton who served the Earl of Essex and had a horse of strange qualities.
Strange horse.
And being at the Cross Keys in Gracious Street, getting money with him, as he was mightily resorted to... Tarleton then, with his fellows, playing at the Bell By.
So Bell By, that's the Bell Savage Inn, and that was a playhouse nearby to where the horse was being demonstrated to a crowd. So this is one entertainer who has left his place of work, the Bell Savage, and encounters another by.
Came into the Cross Keys amongst many people to see fashions, which Banks, perceiving to make the people laugh, says Signor to his horse, "Go fetch me the veriest fool in the company." The jade comes immediately, and with his mouth draws Tarleton forth. Is that you being forth?
I was being drawn forth.
Okay.
Horse comes immediately, and with his mouth grabs onto Tarleton. So let's just go back.
Tarleton, with merry words, said nothing. But God a mercy horse.
Said nothing but.
But.
God a mercy horse.
Tarleton, with merry words, said nothing, but God a mercy horse.
God a mercy horse.
God a mercy horse.
God a mercy horse.
God a mercy horse. God a mercy horse. God a mercy horse.
Yeah, I think that's the one I like.
Good.
We could do this for days.
In the end, Tarleton, seeing the people laugh so, was angry inwardly and said,
"Sir, had I a
Sir,
power of your
had
horse,
I the power of your horse as you have, I would do more than that."
Where it be said Banks to please him, where it was said by Banks to please him, I will charge him to do it. I think.
Yeah.
Is that how? I think it's a bit of a weird sentence.
So Banks is saying, "I will charge him to do it."
I think that's it.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Where'er it be said Banks to please him, I will charge him to do it. Then, says Tarleton,
charge him to bring me the veriest whoremaster in this company.
He shall, says Banks.
He shall, says Banks. Senior, says he.
So that's a continuation. He shall, says Banks. Signor, is obviously what you call the horse, says he. Bring Master Tarleton. It must be Master, yeah. Isn't it? It's not Mister. Yeah.
Signor, says he, bring M. Tarleton here, the veriest whoremaster in the company. The horse leads his master to him. Then
God a mercy horse indeed,
says Tarleton.
Then God a mercy horse indeed.
Then God a mercy horse indeed, says Tarleton.
Now, the people have much ado to keep peace because this was all hilarious. I mean, the thing is, Tarleton's been bested and he doesn't like that very much at all. He's been dragged along by going, God a mercy horse indeed. It's all funny. But Banks and Tarleton had like to squared, so they're all square, had like to square, they're all squared. And the horse to give aim. But ever after it was byword through London, God a mercy horse was the catchphrase of the day. It was.
The people had much ado to keep peace. But Banks and Tarleton had like to
squad. Squared?
Square?
Quad?
Squad? And the horse by to give aim.
The people had much ado to keep peace, but Banks and Tarleton had light to squared, and the horse by to give aim. But ever after it was a byword through London, God a mercy horse, and is to this day.
But ever after it was a byword through London.
God a mercy horse.
And is to this day. Shall we crash on?
Yeah. It's another one of you had to be there.
You did.
Yeah.
God a mercy horse.
God a mercy horse.
Thank you for that.
If you have enjoyed this extended journey into this particular jest, you'll be pleased to know that there is more where this comes from, as I'm going to be recording all of Tartan's jests next year. I say next year, next years. Who knows how long this is going to take? There are rather a lot of them. And that's going to be with commentary and discussion from actors in the studio, as here, as well as a sort of proper version, as we try to untangle the funny and the context and the history. And if you like Banks and his horse, we're also recording a pamphlet written as a dialogue between Banks and his horse. Yes, the horse goes full Mr. Ed. And that's Banks Bay Horse in a Trance, coming anon. But this digression has gone on long enough, so apologies, and back to Sophie Shortland and more on this jest and Tarleton.
A lot of Tarleton's humour in the jest book, anyway, depends on this kind of almost takes the structure of a challenge, some kind of conflict, duel, and then Tarleton comes out on top. But there's this moment where we don't know if Tarleton's going to be publicly humiliated, but it's always potentially in the offing. So there's this kind of pleasurable fear in the joke, I think, as well. You know, there is an actual fight. So Tarleton's humour was quite physical as well. And he was master of fence. He was made master of fence in 1587. That may have been part of his kind of jig persona on stage.
Is there anything he was bad at? it's quite annoying, you know. Fencing, music, you know, comedy.
Yeah. I mean, he did have a squint and a flat nose. So he wasn't classically handsome, I don't think. If that makes it any better.
Well, you know, again, fits within the logic of comedy.
Yeah, he in the jests, he has a very combative relationship with his wife, and she's kind of constantly implying that he's a cuckold. You know, maybe an uneasy domestic situation. But on the other hand, that kind of jest does read a bit like a kind of performative comedic couple.
Yeah.
And the jests also get her name wrong, so probably made up.
Yeah, it's that thing of making yourself weaker for comic effect. So it's, you know, a lot of stand-ups do that, where they undermine themselves and make themselves, you know. So the idea of suggesting that you are impotent or that your wife is happily having it off with lots of other people adds to the comic persona.
Although that's very British. I've tried to be self-deprecating in the US, and people take you seriously.
but even so, the idea of comic characters being failures is an important trope.
Yeah, and kind of being underdogs, and I think that's part of his celebrity appeal. So even though he's moving in these relatively elite circles, we've talked about Philip Sidney, there's the Queen, he's often a kind of intercessor between the Queen and other nobles, so he has this kind of truth to power function. But I think this kind of underdog common man is really important for his appeal. And someone who's not changed by his elevated status.
So, talking of the Queen, how a parsonage fell into Tarleton's hands immediately leaps at me. Talk me through this one.
Yeah, so this one, essentially, a group of lords want the Queen. They're having a great time dining with the Queen. It's very high prestige kind of situation. They want the Queen to stay overnight with them, but she's planning to leave. So the nobles ask Tarleton to intercede with the Queen, and he gets them to promise if he does succeed, they'll give him a parsonage.
Her Majesty dining
Her Majesty.
In the
Strand. Her Majesty. Bit of name dropping there.
Her Majesty dining in the Strand of the Lord Treasurers. The lords were very desirous that she would vouchsafe to stay all night, but nothing could
prevail
with her.
Yeah, she wouldn't listen.
She wouldn't listen.
Well, she was the queen.
Bless her.
Yeah.
Tarleton was in his clown's apparel, bless him, being all dinner whilst in the presence with her to make her merry. And hearing the sorrow that the nobleman made that they could not work her stay, he asked the nobles...
What would you give me to work her stay?
The lords promised him anything to perform it. Quoth he...
Procure me the parsonage of Shard.
They caused the patent to be drawn presently. He got on a parson's gown and a corner cap. And standing upon the stairs where the queen should descend, he repeated these words.
A parson? Or no parson? Again. A parson? Or no parson? A parson?
But after this, she knew his meaning. She not only stayed all night, but the next day willed she should have possession of the benefice. A madder parson was never... For he threatened to turn the bell metal into lining for his purse, which he did, the parsonage and all, into ready money. I like that repeating, darling. That was good repeating.
Thank you. Again, we've done a lot of work on that.
So Tarleton dresses up as a clergyman. As the queen is leaving, he stands on the stairs and asks a parson or no parson. This could be a kind of pun, potentially, or a person or no person, but it might also just be the comic effect of Tarleton dressing as a parson when his kind of persona is so different. It's kind of this jovial, slightly drunk, plain man.
Mm. It's really interesting from a clowning perspective of the thing of simply taking one proposition, it's something relatively straightforward, and just repeating it until it just becomes funnier and funnier. I mean, it's just it's one line, and he's got a silly costume, and he just keeps milking it for laughs. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
Certainly, that's how I would do it. You know, but in the sense
I think it's funny as well because it's very irreverent towards the church, which, you know, when you're being irreverent towards this established institution, it always is a bit funny because you're a bit close to the bone. And then when he gets given a parsonage, he melts the bells down for money and just doesn't really care and continues to be completely irreverent towards the sacred institution.
Yes, it's got a good sting to its tail, that particular thing. A little bit of mad capping before the queen, and then that's what he does.
The poor parishioners who don't get parish bells anymore because Tarleton has melted them down for money. You know, they probably enjoyed listening to bells on Sunday, but no, it's gone in jest. So, and it's all hilarious, and we should find it completely hilarious. But yeah, there's often this kind of slightly on the edge, sometimes cruel sting in Tarleton's jokes, and that kind of goes with this combative public persona.
Do we know if this actually happened or if it's just the story? Just a thought here.
I don't know if it did happen. I haven't found any substantiating evidence, but...
Because, I mean, it might not be as extreme, you know, it might be a case of, yes, he was given a parsonage and he did sell some things, but whether he, you know, I would have thought melting down the bells would, you know, be quite an extreme thing. But maybe that's been exaggerated for comic effect rather than just simply looting the some other more amenable consumables, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and often stories about him kind of, it's subject to huge distortion. Or it might not have even happened to Tarleton, and Tarleton's a good
name,
emblematic
to
figure. Yeah, because everyone knows Tarleton, and this is exactly like something he would do.
I mean, does it actually matter if it is true or not? I mean, that's the thing about celebrities. It doesn't necessarily matter as long as it's a good story or it builds to the myth.
Yeah, totally. Like, and people are also, I think, using celebrities in this time in really interesting ways. So, for example, in The Three Lords and Three Ladies of London, there is a character who tells Tarleton's biography as being exactly the same as his own early life. Mm-hmm. And it's almost certainly completely made up. But he's kind of using the name of Tarleton to give himself status and to say, you know, my early life has this prestige value because it's the same as this celebrity that everyone knows. So there's some really interesting uses of celebrity as kind of part of people's own social network and claiming their own status.
It's also the jests give an indication of how Tarleton works with the stage audience, and that combativeness coming across with how do you relate with your audience, because it's not like he as the clown is necessarily staying exactly in character at any particular point.
No, and this is the thing with clowns, really, they're always still the clown, and that adds to the comedy. Because, you know, and clowns at this time have this thing where they peep onto the stage. So when they're not on stage, they might just poke their head out and everyone falls into fits of laughter because they kind of know that when you see that person's face, you laugh. They're funny.
Yeah.
And they're kind of disrupting the action of the stage as well.
I mean, so it's that Tommy Cooper quality of just simply you are naturally funny to look at. You know, there's nothing, you don't have to do anything. And it's part of modern clown training as well, where, you know, it's just simply you just have to do nothing and be funny. And that's an incredibly difficult skill to do, which Tarleton seems to naturally have or has learnt to have.
And I mean, if we look at an excellent jest of Tarleton suddenly spoken, it's a really good example of actually using the fact that he's always a clown in quite a clever way. So at first he comes on as a judge, he's hit in the stage action, and then he comes on in a separate entrance as the clown, and he makes a jest about still smarting from the blow. So it's really hilarious because he's kind of winking and sharing a joke with the audience that even though he was dressed as a judge, they all know that it was Tarleton, and he can't really be anyone else.
Yes, and they can still see the remains of the blow on his cheek, so his cheek's still red.
At the Bull at Bishopsgate was a play of Henry V, wherein the judge was to take a box on the ear, and because he was absent, that he should take the blow.
Right, so the judge was to take a box on the ear.
At the Bull
at Bishopsgate. Is it the character or is it the actor?
This is what I'm thinking. At the Bull at Bishopsgate was a play wherein the judge was to take a box on the ear in the play. And because he was absent that he should take the blow. Okay.
And because he was absent that he should take the blow, Tarleton himself ever forward
took
to
upon him to play the same judge. Right, okay. So damn that bloody colon.
Yes, that colon
is a bastard colon.
Let's try that one again.
Okay. At the Bull at Bishopsgate was a play of Henry V. Wherein the judge was to take a box on the ear. And because he was absent that he should take the blow, Tarleton himself, ever forward to please, took upon him to play the same judge, besides his own part of the clown.
Tarleton wanting to play all the parts
All the parts.
Yes, recitation by Toad.
Many.
All the parts.
Many parts.
Yes.
And Nell, then playing Henry V, hit Tarleton a sound box indeed, which made the people laugh the more because it was he.
So they thought it was hilarious because it was Tarleton
doing
being hit.
Yes, that's right. So
normally it would be somebody else.
But it wasn't, it was Tarleton.
It was Tarleton, so they thought it was hilarious when it should have been a very serious, dramatic moment.
Absolutely. So they were laughing because of who was boxed.
Because hitting Tarleton is always fun.
But anon the judge goes in, and immediately Tarleton, in his clown clothes, comes out.
So, quick change.
Quick change is
super
now a clown.
Quick change, absolutely,
And he asks the actors, what news?
Oh!
Saith one.
Hadst thou been here, thou shouldst have seen Prince Henry hit the judge a terrible box on the ear.
What man, saith Tarleton, strike a judge?
It is true, i' faith,
said the other. No other like, said Tarleton. And it could not be but terrible to the judge when the report so terrifies me that methinks the blow remains still on my cheek that it burns again.
So so here's his clever wordplay to a heckle from the audience. the news of the strike is so bad that it makes my cheek burn again. Red. And, you know, that
and they think that's very funny. And
because he's doubling.
Because he's doubling. Mm. So the people laugh at this mightily. Mm. And to this day, I heard it commended for rare.
Oh, yeah, rare. Excellent, good.
But no marvel, for he had many of these.
Tarleton was like that. He could come up like that.
I'll tell you what, that Tarleton.
Yeah, no, he was great.
He was. But I would see our clowns in these days do the like. No, I warrant ye, and yet they think well of themselves too.
So those new so they clowns, think, they new think clowns, they're all that.
They think they're all that. As my that. Grandmother would say, body every self. So they're not.
So actually, that works.
Okay.
I get the joke. I think you had to be there.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. I think you had to be there.
Yeah, you did have to be there.
You had to be there.
But I can see that it was funny.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and you have to wonder, so it was Henry V who hit him, well, the character. So was that kind of a slight revenge hit if it was particularly hard at Tarleton? And then there's this kind of really fraught player dynamic happening behind the scenes. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it creates a lovely sense of the company of, you know, you know, because status as an actor, your importance is partly to do with the audience response. And of course, if you're trying to get serious emotional impact in your part and the clown refuses to stop up, you know, doing clowning, because there is a point about, you know, there has to be a balance at some point with the clown, that the clown actually has to say, no, okay, I'm going to stop for a bit or not be on. And where the balance lives. And is Tarleton just basically an insufferable show-off?
I mean... yeah.
We have no answer, obviously.
Possibly, but also, he does have an important role in kind of telling hecklers to shut up and to pay attention. So, you know, when people are heckling, he will be the one who puts himself in the forestage and kind of says... you know, makes fun of them until they're kind of shamed into being quiet or leaving.
And it is interesting, I know this from experience, that it's very difficult to stop a heckler if you're playing a serious part. And actually that suggests that they're actually very important to controlling the audience.
And of course we're in a time when the audience is much more participatory and rowdy, and speaking all the way through a play is totally normal. Doing things is normal. Talking to the actors while the actors are on stage is normal, and distracting them.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, the audience jokes around and upstages the players. So, yeah, there is this kind of crowd control function of clowns. And Tarleton seems... So, you know, maybe as an actor, he would upstage... the actors sometimes, but he's also sometimes putting himself between players and audience and kind of enabling the action to continue.
How Tarleton flouted a lady in the court is an interesting one.
Oh yeah, it's a particularly cruel one, this one. And the kind of example, so Tarleton very often makes people flee in shame, so there's often a victim of the joke. So you know, everyone else is feeling great and warm because they're all laughing together, but there's very often a victim. Sometimes we fear that it's going to be Tarleton, but he always manages to kind of offload that position onto someone else. And in this joke, a group of ladies are having a great time banqueting. One lady who's very pimply and has heat at her stomach is refusing to drink wine with the rest of the ladies, so potentially she's in a bit of a bad mood or bringing the party down a bit.
Upon a time, Tarleton, being among certain ladies at a banquet, which was at Greenwich, the Queen then lying there, one of the ladies had her face full of pimples with heat at her stomach, for which cause she refused to drink wine amongst the rest of the ladies, which Tarleton, perceiving, for he was there of purpose to
jest
amongst them, quoth he,
"A murrain of that face, which makes all the body fair, the worse for it."
At which the rest of the ladies laughed, and she, blushing for shame, left the banquet.
And Tarleton, seeing this, says you have a moraine of the face. So moraine is disease of the sheep, which is making your whole body bad, basically.
Her face full of pimples.
Which it
is quite cruel. He's picking the weakest person in the room, perhaps, to...
He is, yeah. And it's... I didn't think it would go down very well with the modern audience because her symptoms either suggest pregnancy or period. Yeah. So, you know, in our current climate, I just don't think that would go down very well.
I mean, it does suggest that she actually... She, blushing for shame, left the banquet. So it does look like she was a genuine victim as opposed to gentle mockery, if that makes sense. It does seem like this was a bit more vicious.
Tarleton's audiences very often leave the scene.
Well, it is
and they often make a gesture of shame, so they blush or they pull their hat over their eyes or they have look at the floor. For, you know, it's quite physically written on their bodies.
Mm. And, you know, it does say the rest of the ladies laughed, so it's almost the rest of the room turns on her, you know. Yeah. It might be the Charlton's going, oh, that went a bit far. But, you know...
But, I mean, possibly she'd been being really grumpy and insufferable.
Yeah, maybe like, everybody hated her and, you know, it was justice rather than revenge.
Possibly a cruel time to pick on her, but maybe it had been weeks and it was just too much and some humour needed to kind of get it out in the open that everyone's finding you too grumpy.
Get
you
over
need to
yourself.
Check your attitude, yeah. Yeah.
So all of these are coming after his death as either remembered or mythologised. Got this epigram
from John Davies. Yeah.
So 29 years after death.
Here within this sullen earth lies Dick Tarleton, Lord of Mirth, who in his grave still laughing gapes, sith all clowns since have been his apes.
It's interesting that all clowns since Tarleton have been his apes. Mm. So, you know, everyone's tried to copy Tarleton and no one's quite the original. Well, and I always imagine Tarleton as having, you know, what's that comedian who, he's not so famous now, but he's the pub landlord, Al...
Oh, Al Murray, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I imagine Tarleton as being. But that's quite a distinctive persona, really, because he goes on stage with a pint and, you know... That's his trademark. So
it's interesting because there's elements. I keep seeing different comedians in him. At least the myth of him is every good comic you've ever seen.
Yeah.
He does all the things.
Yeah. Although, you know, obviously this is, we've mainly been looking at one version of the myth. So this is we've mainly been looking at Tarleton's jests. but there's some kind of controversy and a very small pamphlet war, I mean like two pamphlets, arguing over his legacy. So we have Tarleton's News Out of Purgatory, in which the ghost of Tarleton returns in a dream vision and reveals the secrets of purgatory, including walking over a field of burning plowshares, which I find quite an entertaining punishment, which I wouldn't feel entertaining if you were actually doing it. But then we have the Cobbler of Canterbury comes out and completely rips into Tarleton's News Out of Purgatory and says, this is absolutely nothing like Tarleton. You've got him completely wrong. You've got his style is too low and too high at the same time. So I'm not quite sure. But there's you know, there's something very specific about Tarleton, this writer, Henry Chettle, feels that the former pamphlet has just completely got wrong. So I think there's also a kind of attachment to one's own version of the celebrity and the celebrity that you've imagined in your own head and that you've potentially imagined a relationship with. So when someone else creates the celebrity in text and fictionalizes them, it can have quite a violent reaction because it's like, no, I know that person. I know them much better.
But they're all very colourful. They're all very alive. You get a sense of a personality here, even if it's, you know, through a glass darkly. I think it'd be quite an interesting exercise to, you know, present those different sides you know, side by side as I always think of how could I turn this into a show, and actually, you know, competing Tarletons.
Oh yeah, yeah, that would be great. Yeah, and they're all dressed the same and look the same,
but they're all slightly different
outward signifiers. But yeah, they are all slight, and there's something almost indefinable in their personalities that is the real heart of celebrity. And I think with celebrity in general, we often have this kind of, there's the public self and then there's the secret self. And so trying to find the core essence of that person, that secret self, I think it's the kind of fuel of gossip magazines and things like that. But that's definitely present in Tarleton as well.
So in the sense that he's, I mean, the other element, of course, about celebrity is a lot of it is about making money. And of course, every one of these jests and things and images are about trying to sell you things. Is that a fair comment?
Yes, totally. And so, yeah, putting Tarleton's name on something means that you will sell copies. And some pamphlets are just completely, they literally only have Tarleton's name on the title page, and then they don't mention him again. so it's completely exploitative of his reputation. And really interestingly as well, potentially his image was sold by people on the streets. So you could buy an image of Tarleton and take it home with you, maybe hang it up, have a little shrine to your favourite celebrity. I don't know.
Because you were saying his the audience is demanding him and getting a picture.
Yeah, so after his death, Robert Armin narrates this story. I mean, you know, again, is this story factual, is it not? But anyway, whatever. Where a collier, so someone who works in the coal trade, comes to London and demands to see Tarleton, to which everyone laughs and is like, well, ha ha, he's dead, you provincial, who you don't know that the most famous man in London has died. But the collier watches a play, and the play shows a picture of Tarleton on stage, and so the collier laughs and goes away glad-hearted. So he's happy to have just seen a picture of his favorite celebrity, and it kind of has this strong emotional impact on him. And it's almost kind of what he expects from a trip to London, is that warmth and that connection with Tarleton.
Now, going on a slight tangent, obviously there are other Tarletons that live on, shall we say, in animal form.
Yes.
So the myth takes an interesting sidestep.
Yeah, so we have a celebrity fighting cock called Tarleton, which is very interesting. It's interesting to think with animal celebrities why they were given these names. I mean, maybe this celebrity cock had a bit of a squint or a funny walk or something, or was particularly physically strong. I don't know. But yeah, so that suggests a kind of shared celebrity culture with between humans and animals. We also have a celebrity bear who's called Mole Cut Purse. So Mole Cut Purse was a very famous cross-dresser. She also liked to duel, famous for smoking tobacco as well, an early tobacco adopter.
And as featured in The Roaring Girl, which we have discussed in other podcasts.
Great.
This was what was the animal again for Mole Cut Purse?
A bear.
A bear.
So I like to think that maybe the bear's gender identity was slightly ambiguous, and that's the reason for it being called Mole Cut Purse. But I mean, I think that might be wishful thinking on my part, as a kind of really interesting early modern phenomenon.
Because she was a celebrity of a slightly, in a sense, of a different order, in the sense that she wasn't, you know, obviously a player, shall we say, but has a connection with the stage, with the play, and the possibility that she actually performed in the play. So
yeah, she may have appeared in The Roaring Girl, but also, to an extent, her life was kind of a performance. So she had to do public penance at St. Paul's for her, you know, basically cross-dressing and being a bit too out there with her personality. And she made the whole thing into this performance. So John Chamberlain, the diarist, recalls it. And he says that the preacher that day was really boring, and everyone was just there to witness Moll at her public penance, and she got maudlin drunk, and everyone had a great time because she was you know, being very emotional and drunk, and it sounds hilarious and potentially quite deliberately staged on Moll's part in this to be performative.
Do we know? So what time period were these with this cock and this bear in action? I mean, presumably the bear was involved with bear baiting, or was it just a demonstrator?
Yeah, so the bear was involved with bear baiting. Yeah, and the bear's around during the Civil War, so late.
Oh, so that late.
Yeah, Moll had quite a long life, though, so she lived through the Civil War.
Yeah, I'm sorry, thinking late in terms of Tartan. No, we're talking Moll Cutlass, yes.
No, but the height of her fame was much earlier.
Yeah.
But she lived for quite a long time. Mm. And then Tarleton, the fighting cock, was around 1603, that kind of time. So earlier.
The jests are around at that time. You know, his reputation is still very much alive.
Although then Tarleton was used, you know, he was on street signs until at least the end of the 18th century. So he did have quite a long public reputation.
So that combative element, that does seem to make sense. You know, if he was a fencer and, you know, good with stage combat, you know, the idea that you would name a cock after him sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
Do we know how successful the cock was?
Well, he is recorded by name, which suggests that he was quite popular. The name is because he makes the sound like a drummer with his wings.
Oh, I see.
So it's like Tarleton with his table, his small drum, which is a very... you know, very much connected with Tarleton. Mm. Yeah, sorry, had forgotten that connection. Yeah, so Tarleton, yeah, the fact that he's, and that this is known about him, is more than we have for a lot of fighting cocks. So he was probably around for a while and relatively popular, same with Moll Cutpurse. And Moll Cutpurse, the bear, is mentioned by name in a few adverts, suggesting she's a bit of a draw to the bait. And yeah, and other kind of other celebrity animals like Harry Hunks was a very famous bear, and the name Hunks actually became a kind of a popular word meaning grumpy, and that was in slang use in England until the 19th century.
So it was a grumpy bear.
Although, I mean, any bear would be really grumpy. I don't know how this bear got a reputation for being particularly grumpy.
It probably just had...
The bait is just horrible.
Yes, I was going to say, it's, you know, is it sort of like a grumpy cat? It just had a particularly miserable-looking face and, you know, miserable profession.
And then was blinded, so, you know, which happened to all bears because the dogs were trained to go for their eyes because it's a sensitive part. So, and that's how the cocks were trained as well, to go for one another's eyes. Mm. So it's really horrific. It's very brutal. Well, there are some fun ones as well, like a country curate, George Wilson, his favourite or his fighting cock, Ipsy, becomes a local celebrity, and everyone admires him so much that they make a poem celebrating him. They embroider his face onto a banner, and then they parade Ipsy round the streets and fire a military salute over him. That one's a bit less depressing.
Anything? I think we've sort of covered our three primary celebrities. Anything else you think we've not covered, or any interesting tangents that you think we could mention?
I mean, gambling on celebrity is quite fun as well. So I mentioned the Fishwives of Billingsgate, and sometimes these were made into official kind of swearing matches, and people would gamble on the winner. Mm-hmm. The winner probably being judged by applause, but it's difficult to tell. And this is interesting. This is interesting because actors like Edward Allen also appeared in these kind of matches, although it was a bit more stately, so they would have act-offs where they kind of monologued. Comedians like John Taylor would also do it, where they'd kind of have a contest of wit, and the contestants would get a percentage of the kind of bookkeeper's take. So that's quite a fun phenomenon, and that connects a lot of celebrities of different types as well, in quite surprisingly.
Well, I have to say I've been working on doing effectively an act-off style thing some of our live shows. Well, it's sort of it's partly just simply because we got lots of bits of plays and speeches and things that, you know, we might not get round to for ages. So we, you know, a way of sort of doing some material and sort of doing it in that sort of style of. You know,
well, you
really, and so there's a precedent which makes me very, very happy. Well, it's the other thing, you know, how do you supplement your income as an actor, you know, in this tricksy profession? And, and you know, it's that kind of thing of, it's like with sportsmen and, you know, you do the main circuits or whatever, but you look for other ways of generating money. So, you know, snooker players doing the sort of exhibition circuit where, you know...
Yeah, and it's a way of capitalising on extant celebrity status.
Yeah.
So, obviously, if you arrange an act-off, you need some celebrities to draw an audience because no one wants to watch two random people acting because that's not fun. But then the actors are kind of putting their reputation at stake. So if they don't do very well... they might suffer a hit in their celebrity. So it's kind of, they are gambling to an extent as well as the audience. And the audience then has the opportunity to decide which actor is best. So for their money, for their investment, they have some power over this very high status celebrity.
Yes, the sense of the actor is gambling themselves, putting some pressure onto what they're doing in a way that maybe the rest of their performances are slightly less pressured, depending on where they are in the company. All the dynamics.
Yeah, no, it's really, really interesting. And also, you know, there's not such a divide between high culture and low culture. You know, we think of gambling casinos as a bit, you know, lots of people are a bit sniffy, whereas the theatre is very high culture. Whereas, you know, it's not at all like that. It's this very chaotic and participatory space.
Very good. I'm very happy with that. And that's it for this discussing episode. And I'd like to thank Sophie Shoreland for talking with me and sharing some early modern celebrities and helping set an interesting series of tangents and confirming a tangent we were already working on for this podcast and for live shows. I'd also like to thank Lee, Hugh and Mark for putting up with the process of playing around with those texts. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton, and, well, what can I say to close but, God a mercy horse indeed.
Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Then God a mercy horse indeed. Indeed.
I don't think it's right, but I like it. I think you've said it enough times. You know this is just going to be on a constant loop at the end of the episode. Just us going, really? Oh, yeah, I'm definitely going to. God a mercy horse indeed. Every possible way of saying God
a mercy
horse
indeed.
We discuss at length whether this line is funny.
God a mercy horse indeed. Oh, God, that was